It may not be evident at first reading of the text, this story of Jesus, Bartimaeus, and the disciples, but there's a whole lot of name-calling going on in this text. The name-calling begins with how Jesus is referred to. For we're told that Jesus and his disciples came to Jericho, and in the same sentence, Jesus and his disciples leave Jericho. That's a quick visit. That's a really quick visit. The point, I think, of Mark is to set the stage for what happens outside of the city of Jericho. And they tell him, they let this blind beggar, this nobody, know who is passing by. And note how they refer to him. Jesus, and in the Greek it says, the Nazarene. Now that may seem just merely descriptive, except in that day, it was well known to everyone that people who came from Nazareth were nobodies because it was backwater. It would be like saying, perhaps in our common parlance, Jesus of the Trailer Park Boys. It was a disparaging reference. It was a reference to sideline and demean this person. Jesus the Nazarene. Call him a name. Everybody knew. The other kind of name-calling that's going on is in the very name of the person in this story around whom Jesus gathers, and the crowd has a mixed reaction. The one called Bartimaeus. And in the text, it spells it out, means son of Timaeus. But it doesn't tell us really what's behind that name. You see, in Aramaic, which is the language that Jesus spoke and many of the people in Jericho would have been speaking, that the Greek tries to translate, Bartema means son of poverty or son of the unclean. It was a disparaging reference to this beggar. He's known as the son of the unclean, the son of the poor, who happens to hear that this Jesus of the backwater trailer park is passing by. Two persons who have received disparaging names find each other. It is not an accident. It is an interesting coming together of a dramatic experience. Let us look and see how we may find ourselves in this story. Because the questions are poignant. The questions are alive. And before going any further, we are, I believe, all invited to put ourselves in Bartimaeus' place and to respond from the deepest recesses of our need as we can ascertain it. When Jesus confronts us and looks us in the eye, looks into our heart and says, "What do you want me to do for you?" How do we answer that question? Do you know what you want Jesus to do for you? Another question, indirect question, might be, in what ways might we refer to Jesus by name, by action, that similarly disparages his reputation? Oh, it's just the Nazarene, the trailer park boy who's passing by. How do we refer to Jesus? What diminishing status does Jesus have in our practice, our faith, our theology, our talking about him? Is a question not obvious in the text, but nonetheless there. Because they try to distance this man from Jesus, and it is unclear who makes reference to this, Jesus the Nazarene. But what is clear is the intent. What is also clear is the way in which this man is sidelined. He is found outside the gates of Jericho. He is found, it says, by the way, the hodos, on the roadside, marginalized. He is literally very close to the gutter, and he's begging. And that's significant because as a beggar, a blind beggar, obviously he needs to be brought there by someone, and then he takes up his place. Because we know from what follows in Mark that Jesus and the crowd are going to Jerusalem on pilgrimage. It is the reception of hosannas that awaits Jesus when he makes that trek, that 40-kilometer trek from Jericho up a steep incline to Jerusalem. And so the beggars would come out hoping that a excited sense of piety, that people who were on their way to pilgrimage to do homage to God might be more disposed to reach into their pouches and put some money on his cloak. And so there he was. But irrespective of all the name calling, this Bartimaeus, this son of poverty or son of the unclean, refuses to accept the moniker that has been given to this Jesus. What is very poignant and significant is that he sees, despite his blindness, something about the nature of Jesus that those around seem to miss. So he cries out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Now that is quite a title. You see, Son of David captures the experience and the feeling of the time that the Messiah was coming. And this Messiah would be a son of David. But it also makes reference to the most famous son of David, Solomon, whom it was reported was a benefactor, was generous, and also is attributed to have had some healing properties in the modern lore at that time. So when he says that, that little phrase is a pact statement. He corrects the misnomer. He corrects the name calling. He sees who Jesus really is. Isn't it interesting how those who are often marginalized, whom we discard in our societal life, see the truth much better than do we? "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." You would think perhaps that some of the people might say, I guess we got it wrong, this Jesus from the backwater. Maybe this man sees something we didn't. And so the reaction would be to thank you for correcting us. We really appreciate that, Mr. Blind Beggar, right? That's how the story goes. What do? They tell him, "Shut up, idiot. Shut up. Be quiet. This Jesus has no time for you. You're a nobody. Who are you crying out? Don't you know your place?" And as a result of that, yet another insult upon Bartimaeus, he just remains silent and cowers and hopes for a few more pennies, right? That's how the story goes? No. He refuses to allow others' designation of him, others' marginalization of him, to undermine what he has seen with his heart and with his faith. They will not cause him to abandon what has come and as he has intuited and declares. And so the Bible says he cries out all the louder. He raises his voice. He will not be silent. And he cries out. And Jesus hears him. And the Bible says, and Jesus stopped and called him. Now, how is that possible? How is he going to make his way to Jesus except others help him? Notice how fickle you and I can be. Because I think we are sometimes the crowd, don't you? We try and silence people who don't quite fit in, who we don't want to ascribe standing. Just be quiet. Just stay in your place. But when Jesus stops, when the main man stops and says, "Come," and calls him, what does the crowd do? They go to him and say, "Come, take heart." Take heart. He's called you. All of a sudden, they're very friendly. all of a sudden there's been a change in their attitude towards him. Jesus can do that, you know, like that. Jesus has a way of cutting through things and can challenge a crowd like you and me. Come. There's another interesting thing here about you and I sometimes ask, how do we find Jesus? How do we get hold of Jesus? It is interesting that in this text and in the text leading up to today, that we're hearing all the time that Jesus is on the way. And that is a very significant phrase in Mark, and I'll come back to that. But inasmuch as Jesus is moving, always moving with purpose and determination towards the reign of God, towards challenging people to live their lives in obedience to God, even if that is the case, notice what happens here that I think is true for Bartimaeus and true for you and me and for anyone who seeks and really wants. Jesus stands still. Jesus does not create a moving target to make it so hard for us to find him that we fail. People sometimes say to me, I don't know about this Jesus. I don't know about God. I can't, not real to me. I think it's a very important narrative instrument to say Jesus stopped. He's on his way, but he stopped. Jesus will remain accessible and available for any who are looking. For any who really want to find him, Jesus is findable. Any English teachers here, just forgive that one, would you please? Jesus is findable. If you want to find him, he will stop and stand still and call you to come. But there's some effort on your part, on my part. Seek and you shall find. You will find him. He will not be a moving target. Say, ha, miss me. Hey, you looking for me? Ha, miss me. Ha, ha. Well, stop and you will find what you look for. What is interesting about that finding and that calling is the way in which all of us are involved in the action of God. God chooses to express and execute his mercy through the community. For though the call is made to Bartimaeus, it is executed by people who bring him to Jesus. And so you and I are instrumental in mediating the mercy that God intends for the world and for those whom we meet. You and I have a role to play. For we may be the ones who are shutting up the marginalized, but we still have a role to play. A role to play to draw others to Jesus. There's something else that's very significant if we're going to be able to see. And do not derive from this text any aspersions cast on those who are unsighted persons, because it is troublesome when we deal with texts about those who are blind receiving their sight for people who are blind. So, well, I prayed to receive my sight and it hasn't happened to me. Jesus did not heal everybody who was blind. And it is significant also to note that in this particular case, it is the unsighted man who sees much better than the sighted ones, who has a vision far deeper and an understanding and intuition about the nature of God and the purposes of Jesus better than all who could see, even his disciples who followed. Because remember, Jesus asked that same question to his disciples that are arguing about who is going to be better. What do you want me to do for you? And what do they answer? To see better? To care more, to help the poor, to wrestle for justice, to call people to faith? Is that what they asked for? When Jesus asked, what do you want me to do for you? What did they ask for? Let me sit on your right hand. Let me sit on your left hand. Let us be powerful. Let us be the main man, well, next to you, Jesus, but let us be the ones. That's what they asked for. At least they were honest, but not appropriate. The question comes back, what do you want Jesus to do for you? For me? That's the question. And that question invites us to go deep, deep, deep into what will most satisfy. That question will help us to see the way, because seeing, Mark Twain used to say that the eye cannot see what the imagination has not focused upon. There's something deeper than the physical capacity to see. And we know that. I was talking with someone this week about just that business about sight. We have stories recorded of those who have been blind or maybe were able to see and then went blind and able to see again. And what the doctors tell us, and there are many here, in terms of optic nerve and so forth, it's one thing to repair the mechanics of sight. So if this miracle happens as is reported and this man who's blind from birth is now able to see, just having his eyes work isn't sufficient. There is what some people call a double miracle here. Because just being able to see with one's eye, seeing requires a memory of experience with depth perception, visual images, how to make sense of what the eye physically sees. So what happens to this man that is able to see and follow Jesus is that he's not only given physical sight, but he is also given all of the mental and the emotional and the perceptual apparatus needed to execute sight. If we ask to see, may it be that we truly see. And one last thing I want to make reference to that is a more structural thing. When you hear the city Jericho, what do you remember from Sunday school? Do you remember that city, Jericho? Joshua fit the battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Joshua fit the battle of Jericho and the... Do you remember in Joshua 6, on the seventh day, the people circle around and around and around the city of Jericho, the trumpet blasts, and the people do what? Shout. There is a literary and a theological connection between this story of Bartimaeus and the story of Jericho. It's challenging, a little bit problematic, because what happens as the wall falls, the people interpret that God has authorized them to go in and slaughter everybody and animals and so forth. Just something theologically we need to wrestle with about how the purposes of God are accomplished. But what is clear in this particular rendition of the outside of the walls of Jericho happening is that similarly we have someone who is shouting and walls begin to fall. The wall of unsightedness, the wall of repulsion of those who are marginalized. For the transformation happens within the group, from those who wanted to shunt to one side the blind beggar, to those who are now drawing him, encouraging him on his way to Jesus. The wall of lack of vision on the part of the disciples. Lots begin to crumble because this man shouted. And what's more is that when he follows Jesus on the way, which means the way that God is going through Jesus is not merely a geographical way, meandering himself from that 40 kilometers northeast of Jerusalem all the way up to Jerusalem. On the way means the way in which God is going to bring the reign of God in. By way of justice and salvation and hope and joy and peace and generosity. So what he does is follow, and we have a disclosure here that the way that God is going to bring about the results of the tumbling walls and bring the kingdom to bear is not through sword and violence, but through joy and justice and laughter and salvation and hope. And peace. And this shouting one who has crumbling walls of separation follows on the way and invites us as an archetype, as a model of how we, as those like the disciples that don't get it, can follow. It's good news, don't you think? I think. Because if the disciples who spent time with Jesus on earth and followed and listened to him didn't get it, were as dunce as anything, boy, there's hope for me. There's hope for me. If they didn't get it and needed repetitive invitations to see, not only with their ocular function, but with their imaginations and their heart and their resolve and their ethics. And they agitated the agitation of this particular man who cried out all the more in a non-violent way, "There's hope for me." I had the experience yesterday of going to the Fill the Hill. Any of you were there at the Fill the Hill? Fill the Hill was worldwide, a global invitation to make a voice loud, to shout loudly to our policymakers and our governments around the world to do something about climate change. And I have to tell you that I was in the pouring rain and so forth, but I was actually energized by this. I must be getting old, I think. Because the majority of the people there were young and they were vibrant, took their boots off, dancing in the rain, listening to samba. Samba group was there and it was a great party. But the message was clear: we need to do something about our climate now. And it was the energy and the activism of those people that rekindled in me a sense of fervor. Those that we would try to marginalize, issues we would try to marginalize, need to shout and bring the walls of inactivity and inaction down, so that we may follow on the way, seeing the way and following.